Hello, welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do Imperium, Philosophy of History and Politics by Ulrich Virang, pen name for Francis Parker Yockey. He wrote this in Ireland. It's about 650 pages, more or less. It's got about a 50-page introduction that we're going to do today by a late publisher, Willis Carto, that will kind of put it in context. Let's start first by looking at Metapedia and the facts they have about Francis Parker Yockey's life. Born September 18th, 1917, died June 16th, 1960. He only lived 42 years. Died by suicide, cyanide poisoning in prison. They call him an American-European philosopher, best known for his Neo-Spenglerian, that's Otto Spengler, book Imperium, published under the pen name of Ulrich Virang in 1948, so right after the Second World War. Yockey was born in Chicago, Illinois, to a Catholic family that had ties to Michigan. His parents, Louis and Nellie Yockey, were Anglophiles who raised him. His two sisters, one named Alice and a brother, to appreciate European high culture. So they were the Catholic sort that admired England and European high culture, she says, or Metapedia says. His father had legal training but worked as a stockbroker. Yockey was introduced to classical music through his mother, who studied at the Chicago Musical College. He proved to have a prodigious talent for the piano and developed his repertoire to include Liszt, Beethoven, Chopin, and Haydn. Education and military service. Yockey attended several universities, including University of Michigan, later transferred to Georgetown, and the University of Arizona, where he received his BA degree. His graduate studies took him to Northwestern, DePaul University Law School, and University of Notre Dame Law School, where he graduated cum laude, receiving his law degree in 1941. He reportedly had an IQ of 170, which is very, very, very high. Yockey enlisted in the U.S. Army and served in an intelligence unit based in Georgia. During this time, he disappeared from his base. The FBI later speculated he was engaged in espionage. While in service, he allegedly had a nervous breakdown and received an honorable discharge in July 1943. It has been suggested he faked his condition to get an early discharge. Political contacts and activity. Yockey flirted with Marxism momentarily in his youth, but later became a devotee of the elitist and anti-materialist Oswald Spengler. After reading, and that's true, this is a very Spenglerian text, Imperium is basically his sort of take in the light of or context of Spengler's Decline of the West. And he became a Spengler, and after reading Spengler's seminal text, Der Untergang des Abendlandes, the Decline of the West, or the Untergang, undergang would be the past tense of going, the undergoing of the West, the decline of the West. While still a student, he read that in 1934. Remember, he died in 48, so while still a university student in the late 1930s, Yockey had his first political essay titled The Tragedy of Youth, published in Social Justice, a periodical distributed under the auspices of Father Charles Coughlin, who at the time was widely known for his sympathetic view of the anti-Bolshevist policies associated with Hitler's Germany. And he would sell this magazine on the street, and Jewish criminals would destroy the copies and destroy the newsstands of those who carried it. So those who say Jews triumphed without ever firing a shot ignore that they did use illegal activity and violence to suppress anyone who had a mass following, such as Father Coughlin back in the 30s. And so Father Coughlin's, whose views were, he was known for a sympathetic view of the anti-Bolshevist policies associated with Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy, and Franco's Spain. During this period, Yockey contacted a number of nationalist organizations. These included the German-American Bund, the German-American National Alliance, William Dudley Pelley's Silver Shirts, Sir Oswald Mosley's Union Movement, and James H. Madole's, M-A-D-O-L-E, National Renaissance Party. okay, later life and works. And this is basically just one page here. And then we'll get to the introduction is what we're going to do today. He has himself a brief preface. It was very brief. The bulk of what we're going to do is the introduction by Willis Cardo, the explanation of his life and the meaning and why it's worth publishing his book. After leaving the Army, Yaki returned to Michigan and worked in as an assistant prosecuting attorney for Wayne County. During this time, Yaki married and raised a family. In early 1946, Yaki moved his wife and two small children to occupied Germany in 46, the Nuremberg, where he began working for the United States War Department as a post-trial review attorney for the Nuremberg trials. He soon began agitating against Allied occupation of Germany, as well as what he perceived to be the biased procedures of the Nuremberg Tribunal. Eventually, he was fired for, quote, abandonment of position, unquote, on November 26, 1946. So he goes over to participate in the Nuremberg trial in some capacity. And he doesn't like what's going on, similar to Patton. And he is eventually fired in 46. Thereafter, he traveled a bit about Europe and returned to the U.S. In 47, he abandoned his wife and two daughters and went into self-exile in Brittas Bay, B-R-I-T-T-A-S, Bay, Ireland. Here, without notes, Yaki wrote his, and again, 170 IQ, Yaki wrote, it's all in his head. Yaki wrote his first book, Imperium, over the winter and early spring of 1948. It is a Spenglerian critique of 19th century materialism and rationalism. It was endorsed by patriotic thinkers around the world, including German general Otto Reimer, professor of classics at the University of Illinois, Revolo Oliver, and Italian esotericist Julius Evola. The book was dedicated to the hero of the Second War, presumably Adolf Hitler. Yaki became embittered with Sir Oswald Mosley after the latter refused to publish Imperium upon its completion. Yaki was later able to fund the publishing of his work thanks to the generosity of Baroness Alice von Flügel. 1,000 copies of the first volume and 200 copies of the second volume was published by Westropa Press in London in 1948, year of his death. European Liberation Front. Along with Mosolites Guy Chesham and John Gannon, Yaki formed the European Liberation Front in 1948-49, the year of his death. The ELF issued a newsletter, Front Fighter, and published the group's manifesto, The Proclamation of London, which was written by Yaki himself and summarized the main themes of Imperium, although it is short and therefore does not contain the detailed arguments of Imperium. The Proclamation of London was published in six languages, German, English, Spanish, Italian, French, and Flemish. International travels. In 1950, Yaki returned to Germany and worked for the American Red Cross. And I thought, wait a minute. What year did he die? I thought he died in 48. He died in 1960. But he was 42, so most of his main activity is happening right after the war, and he's only going to be alive for another 15 years max. So in 1950, Yaki returned to Germany and worked for the American Red Cross until 1951. That same year, he went to Italy to organize a foreign delegation to the founding Congress of the Italian Women's Movement, a branch of the Italian Social Movement, and delivered a speech before the Congress. From there, he went to Canada, seeking to create a magazine to be called Fourth Front. He also wanted to help the rebirth of a Canadian nationalist movement. The primary contact in Canada for Yaki was Adrian Arcand, A-R-C-A-N-D, who had led a nationalist party before the Second World War. In 1952, Yaki, using an alias, wrote a letter to U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson on behalf of the Committee for International Justice, requesting U.S. intervention for the release of so-called war criminals and the cessation of harassment against General Otto Reimer. Here are the excerpts, the support for Otto Reimer. Excerpt, quote, "The German National Socialist Movement was only a form, and a provisional form, the great and irresistible movement that expresses the spirit of our era, the resurgence of authority. This movement is the assertion of all cultural trends and all human instincts that liberalism, democracy, and communism deny. The resurgence of authority has both an internal aspect and an external aspect. The interior has been mentioned in the preceding paragraph. Its appearance is the creation of the Imperium European nation-state, Imperium hyphen European nation-state, and the reaffirming the role of Europe ordered by history, that of the force of colonization and organization of the world. This role is historically necessary, and no other force in the world cannot replace Europe for the powerful destiny. Either Europe brings peace and order in the world, or the world will remain in darkness and chaos. That same year, the State Department refused to renew his passport. Prague trials and support for the Soviet Union. In late 52, Yaki traveled to Prague and witnessed the Prague trials. He believed they, quote, foretold a Russian break with Jewry, unquote, a view he put forward in his article, What is Behind the Hanging of the 11 Jews in Prague? The National Renaissance Party published Yaki's analysis in their bulletin. Yaki saw the trials as a watershed event, signaling the Soviet Union's final break with international Jewry. He aligned himself further with the communist bloc of nations and began working as a courier for the Czech Secret Service. In 1953, Yaki published The Enemy of Europe, which we will do after we do Imperium, as an audiobook, first in the German, Der Feind Europas, and later English. Only 200 copies of the first German edition were printed. The, quote, enemy, identified as the United States and her allies, signaled Yaki's shift in strategy in liberating Europe from foreign occupation by tilting toward the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Wonder how he'd see things today. You might think he was precocious. Egypt. Yaki met Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, who he called a great and vigorous man, in Cairo in July and August 1953. He worked briefly for the Egyptian Information Ministry, writing anti-Zionist propaganda. Yaki saw the rise of non-aligned states in the Third World, and in particular the Arab Revolt, as significant geopolitical challenges to, quote, the Jewish American power. Hyphenated Jewish American. Cuba. Yaki had a favorable attitude toward Fidel Castro. He traveled to Cuba and met with a reporter linked to the government. Yaki spoke in support of the rise of third world regimes as outlined in his final essay, The World in Flames. Arrest and death. In 1960, Yaki returned to the United States in June and went to the home of Alex Scarf, as it sounds, a man reported to be Jewish. The precise relationship between Yaki and Scarf is unknown. Yaki had lost a suitcase and called the airport to find it. Meanwhile, however, the airport staff had opened the suitcase and discovered 6 false passports and notified authorities. June 8, FBI agents raided the home of Scharf and found Yaki. He resisted, slamming a door on the hand of an officer, escaping for a moment, but was overtaken in the street. The U.S. Attorney Joseph Koresh, K-A-R-E-S-H, a rabbi, fixed bail at $50,000 against Yaki, apparently on instructions from Washington. While the FBI initially told the press that it was a, quote, mysterious case, and newspapers displayed headlines about the, quote, mystery man, unquote, with 3 passports, he was soon described in the press as an, quote, important fascist with international links, unquote. The authorities decided to refer Yaki to hospital for mental evaluation. After his arrest, Willis Cardo met with Yaki. He would later become a major supporter of Yaki and promoter of his works. Yaki was found dead with an empty cyanide capsule nearby while in a jail cell in San Francisco under FBI supervision after having been incarcerated on charges of using false passports. It's 1960, of course. Yaki and George Lincoln Rockwell were alleged to be foes, due primarily to Rockwell's offense at Yaki's anti-Americanism and sympathies with the Soviet Union and other anti-Zionist and leftist movements such as the Castro regime in Cuba and Nasser in Egypt. proponents of universal national socialism, like Colin Jordan out of the UK, disagreed with Yaki's metaphysical views on race and saw Yakiism as a kind of new Strasserism. It's more of a left-wing philosophy with some racial views as well. And that's pretty much it. Essays and pamphlets, he wrote The Tragedy of Youth, La Vie comme une Art, Life as Art, Why the Americans Did Not Go to Berlin, What is Behind the Hanging of the 11 Jews in Prague, The Destiny of America, The World in Flames, and Yaki, 4 Essays. So that's stuff that's out there if you want to check him at Wikipedia. And now let's look at Imperium and begin with the beginning and then the words by Cardo, which amount to some 50-plus pages. Imperium, title page says, the history of the philosophy of history and politics by Ulrich Vrang, Francis Parker Yaki, 1948, 12 years before his death. The Imperium, the philosophy of history and politics. So very overtly Spenglerian. And is dedicated to the hero of the Second World War. And the quote is, Was mich nicht umbringt, macht mich stärker, which is a famous Nietzsche statement. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Umbringen means kill. Means around. Bring means bring. Bring me around, like bring your life full circle to death, I guess, is what it is originally. But not around brings, macht mich, makes me stärker. Stärker is a comparative form of strong. Stark, strong, stärker, with the umlaut over the A, stronger. Nietzsche. Contents. We don't need to read through that. Just one, section two, section three, section. Just read the titles of the sort of subsections. The 20th century historical outlook, 20th century political outlook, that's page 110 to 234. Cultural vitalism, divided into cultural health and cultural pathology, America, and the world situation. So those are sort of the five or so main subsections of the book. And now we'll get to the introduction, and then he has his own brief forward. So we'll do the introduction and then the brief forward to conclude this, and this will take some time. Like I said, it's pretty long, but this is Willis Cardo, who is let's see. Okay. Willis A. Cardo. Okay. Now with the introduction. Imperium. Much has been said already about this unique and disturbing book, but this much is reasonably certain. 1,000 times more is yet to be said. Imperium is the first sequel the literary world knows to Spengler's monumental The Decline of the West. In fact, the author of Imperium does more than even Spengler attempted. He defines and creates the pathology of culture in all of its infinitely urgent importance, including the discipline of cultural vitalism. Imperium rejects the 19th century, the parched fossils of its thought, Marx, Freud, and the scientific technical world outlook, its exhausted political nostrums, the pluralistic state, liberalism, democracy, communism, internationalism, all of which fail to satisfy the organically vital realities of politics. Imperium presents unique and almost esoteric political, social, and historical definitions and explanations which shall become more widely known, indeed commonly understood, if our West survives. Imperium is probably the first book to advocate European unification, to dogmatically predict it, in terms other than the crassly materialistic. And remember, at this time, Europe was trying to found a European, like a common coal and steel community type of thing. And monetary reform, and link it that way. And that's what he's talking about here, Cardo. Advocating European unification as an imperium under a racial, spiritual, cultural umbrella that's not really Catholic, but is similar and maybe in scope and sort of an intention in order of organizing the whole world, as he's talking about. Imperium is the first comprehensive and profoundly constructive alternative to the Marxist liberal degeneracy surrounding us. Imperium is the creation of a man who believed in his destiny, the capital D, and in this book so thoroughly that he became a martyr to it. Imperium is written with a dramatic style and flair for expression seldom encountered even in novels. Yet rising above all else is the simple fact that in Imperium, a creative genius has given the world something new, a fourth dimension of intellect, and a new concept of spirituality. Imperium heralds the dawn of a new day of faith. So I guess it'd be directly competitive with Catholicism and Christianity. Among all books, therefore, Imperium has a distinct status. Hardly a man alive will agree with all it contains, yet will not find his personal horizons extended by the reading of it. The original two volumes are here combined, unabridged, into one with a brilliant introduction by Willis A. Cardo. Okay, well, I thought that was the introduction, but now the introduction begins. I don't know what that part was. Some kind of marketing material, I guess. Introduction, okay. Dimly, I could make out the form of this man, this strange and lonely man, through the thick wire netting. Inwardly, I cursed these heavy screens that prevented our confrontation. For even though our mutual host was the San Francisco County Jail, and even though the man upon whom I was calling was locked in equality with petty thieves and criminals, I knew that I was in the presence of a great force, and I could feel history standing aside me. Yesterday, the headlines had exploded with their sensational discovery. "Mystery man with three passports jailed here," they screamed. A man of mystery, of wickedness, had been captured. "A man given to dark deeds and, much worse, forbidden thoughts, too," the journalist squealed. "A man who had roamed the earth on mysterious missions and who was found to be so dangerous that his bail was set at $50,000, a figure 10 or 20 times the normal bail for his passport fraud. The excitement of the newspapers and the mystery of it all seemed to indicate that this desperado was an international gangster or a top communist agent. At least this is what the papers hinted. But I know now that it erred in many ways, this free press, quote-unquote, of ours. I know now that the only real crime of Francis Parker Yockey was to write a book, and for this he had to die. A break with three asterisks. It is always impossible, of course, to come to grips with the essence of greatness. There are the known facts of a great life, but the facts are dead and almost mute when we seek the essential reality of a creative personality. But let us review some of the facts we know of a life which is at once significant, fascinating, and tragic. Francis Parker Yockey was born in Chicago in 1917. He attended American universities, taking a BA degree in 1938, and 3 years later, a degree in law from Notre Dame, where he was graduated cum laude. From earliest childhood, Yockey was recognized for his prodigious abilities and resented for them by many. History may reveal that the combination of originality and high intelligence in rare individuals is essential for human progress, but we mortals find these qualities more admired in biographies than in classmates, friends, and underlings. Yockey was a concert-level pianist. He was a gifted writer. He studied languages and became a linguist. As a lawyer, he never lost a case. He had an extraordinary grasp of the world of finance. And this is surprising, for we learn that in his philosophy, economics is relegated to a relatively unimportant position. But even so, he understood finance. And it is as the philosopher that it is as the philosopher, capital P, that Yaki reached the summit. It is this for which he will be remembered. He was a man of incredible vision. Even so, his personality was spiced by the precious gift of a sense of humor. Like the great majority of Americans, Yaki opposed American intervention in the Second World War. Nevertheless, he joined the army and served until 1942, when he received a medical discharge, honorable. The next few years were spent in the practice of law, first in Illinois and subsequently in Detroit, where he was appointed assistant county attorney for Wayne County, Michigan. In 1946, Yaki was offered a job with the War Crimes Tribunal and went to Europe. He was assigned to Wiesbaden, where the, quote, second string, unquote, Nazis were lined up for trial and punishment. The Europe of 1946 was a war-ravaged continent, not the prosperous land we know today. Viewing the carnage and seeing with his own eyes the visible effects of the unspeakable Morgenthau Plan, which had as its purpose the starvation of 30 million Germans, and which was being put into effect at that time, he no doubt found ample reinforcement for his conviction that American involvement in the war had been a ghastly mistake. And feeling the might of the sinister power in the East, he might well have wondered whose interests were being served by such a victory. As Senator Robert A. Taft and many other responsible and thinking men of the day who had the courage to state their convictions, Yaki concluded that the entire procedure of the war crimes trials was serving the interest and was meant to serve the interests, in italics, of international communism. The use of torture, doctored evidence, and ex post facto law, that is, declaring something illegal after it's been done that was not illegal when it was done, before a court, which was a jury, judge, and prosecutor and defense, were merely part of the preposterous juridical aspects. Of even more importance was the reversion to barbarism which was inherent in the spectacle, a reversion so pointedly explored later by Britisher F.J.P. Veal in Advance to Barbarism. For 11 months, Yaki's duty in Wiesbaden was to prepare reports on the various cases. Having a long view of history, he tried to do an objective job. Finally, in Washington, someone complained, and his superior called him on the carpet. "We don't want this type of report," he was told. "This has entirely the wrong slant. You'll have to rewrite these reports to conform with the official viewpoint." Yaki felt that the time had come to take a stand, even if it meant to break with conformity and plunge into the lonely waters of social ostracism. "I am a lawyer, not a journalist," he said. "You'll have to write your own propaganda." And he quit on the spot. After Wiesbaden, he returned to America for 5 months. But following this taste of Weltpolitik, world politics, he was unable to settle down. He could not ignore an insistent feeling that he must immolate himself in the flames of controversy. And this conviction so destroyed his peace of mind that he knew he had no choice. It was late 1947 when Yaki returned to Europe. He sought out a quiet inn at Britis Bay, Ireland. Isolated, he struggled to begin. Finally, he started to write, and in 6 months, working entirely without notes, Francis Parker Yaki completed Imperium. The formidable task of publishing it was the next step. Here also, Yaki ran into serious problems, for no publisher would touch the book, it being too, quote, controversial, unquote. Hungry publishers of our advanced day know that any pile of trash, filth, sex, sadism, perversion, and sickness will sell when wrapped between two gaudy covers and called a book, but under no circumstances may they allow readers to come into contact with a serious work, unless it contains the standard obeisances to the catchwords of equality, democracy, and universal brotherhood. Finally, however, Yaki was able to secure the necessary financing, and production began. The first edition of Imperium was issued in two volumes. Volume 1 has 405 pages and 3 chapters. Volume 2 has 280 pages and also 3 chapters. Both were printed in 1948 in the name of Westropa Press. Volume 1 was printed by C.A. Brooks & Company, Limited, and Volume 2 by Jones & Dale, both of London. Both volumes measure 5 by 7 1/4 inches in dimensions and have a red dust jacket, with the title in black script on a white held. The cover of volume 1 is tan and that of volume 2 is black. It is known that 1,000 copies of volume 1, but only 200 copies of volume 2 were finished. The discrepancy in quantity and the change in printers point to the difficulty in financing the job. Copies of this first edition are, of course, virtually unobtainable today. The rarest combination in man is that of the philosopher and man of action. When Yaqui tried his hand at political organization, he proved that he was no exception to the rule. Or was it that the times were too out of joint with the future for a constructive movement to be started? Organizing the European Liberation Front in 1949, he and friends issued a manifesto called the Proclamation of London. But outside of getting beaten up in Hyde Park, nothing much happened. And here again he encountered the old trouble. Even among the forward-looking intellectuals and individualists who were his co-workers, his brilliance shone through. He was resented, and the effort soon collapsed. His money and immediate hopes gone, Yaqui procured a job with the Red Cross. He resigned in 1951 and traveled throughout Europe. In 1952, the State Department refused to renew his passport. Repeatedly, he applied. Each time, he was rejected. A game then developed between the FBI and Yaqui, for the FBI had received orders to keep him under surveillance at all times. This is a pattern which has since become obvious to vigorous anti-communists in all parts of the United States, especially in the South. When Yaqui's whereabouts was known, the FBI would watch him night and day. When he dropped temporarily from sight, as he did frequently, his friends and relatives and contacts were constantly interrogated by agents who, they kept repeating, just want to talk to him. And this was undoubtedly the truth. This is all they wanted to do. They just wanted to know where he was and what he was doing, whom he was seeing, what he was saying, and where he was going next. Why, you ask? Why all the interest in Francis Parker Yaqui, author? He himself gave the answer to a friend. Quote, "My enemies have evaluated me better than my friends," he said. And it was true. They saw the true and genuine potential threat he presented. Better than his envious friends. ... And as I peered through the thick screens in the San Francisco jail and made out the indefinite shape on the other side that 10th day of June, 1960, I knew that I would have to help the prisoner as best I could. I could do nothing else. "I've read your book," I said to the shadow, "and I want to help you. What can I do?" "Wait," he said. "Wait and do as your conscience tells you." The following week was full of news of Yaqui's appearance before Rabbi Joseph Karish, the U.S. commissioner. Twice I attended the hearings, and each time was fascinated by this man, Yaqui. In stature, he was about 5'10". He was light of weight, perhaps 145 pounds, and quick on his feet. His hair was dark and starting to gray. The expression on his face, pensive, sensitive, magnetic, this was the unforgettable thing. It was his eyes, I think, dark with a quick and knowing intelligence. His eyes bespoke great secrets and knowledge and such terrible sadness. As he turned to leave one time, those eyes quickly searched the room, darting from face to face with a sort of desperation, though the expression on his face was that of a determined resignation and never wavered. What was he looking for? In that lion's den, what else but a friendly countenance? As his gaze swept across, and then to me, he stopped and for the space of a fractional second spoke to me with his eyes. In that instant we understood that I would not desert him. Again, this is Willis Cardo describing his meeting and thinking about Yaqui as he's in the final days of his life, caught up in San Francisco and under the administration of a Jewish rabbi who's a U.S. commissioner. Friday morning, June 17th, I arose as usual. I heard the radio announcer pronounce words that stunned me. Yaqui was dead, as we move on to page 15 of the intro. "I'll sleep through till morning," was the cryptic message he gave his cellmate last night. Was the morning he anticipated the dawn of a new age? A garbled note was found. The coroner declared it suicide and said the poison was potassium cyanide. No one knew where he had gotten it. The case was closed. As Americans, we have been taught from infancy to believe that we live in a free country. But times change, and America has become transformed in many ways. Often the old formalities are observed, but the meaning and the inner reality of America has changed, and no one saw this more clearly than Francis Parker Yockey, Revolution Within the Form. Zelensky parts in the Callahan box. How the press, for example, loves to brag to its victims, its readers, about its freedom. Yes, the press may be free to lie and distort and suppress and deceive and malign, but is it free to tell the truth? The spectacle of a man being persecuted, framed, and driven to his death simply because he wrote a book is not one we would expect to see in the 20th century in the land of the free and the home of the brave. But are we free when an American citizen, whose only crime was to write a book, is denied a passport by the State Department, a privilege which is given to all but the most notorious degenerates and criminals? It was not until April 24, 1962, that the State Department finally got around to beginning hearings to deny passports to the most important communists. But the, quote, free press, unquote, somehow forgot to report at the time that no report of a confidential nature from the FBI or any other source would be used against a communist unless he was given the, quote, right of confrontation with his accuser. And, of course, the right of appeal would be scrupulously honored even then. Are we free when a citizen can be arrested without a warrant and held in jail without charges, but with a fantastic bail of $50,000 levied against him? Are we free when the vultures of the, quote, free press, unquote, can swoop down upon the victim to heap calumny and scorn upon his head and accuse him of doing things he never did and saying things he never said in an effort to build up, quote, public opinion, unquote, against him? Is America a free country when a sensitive genius can be held in the filthiest of jails with Negro and white criminals and is denied even clean clothes and a bath? Are we free when such a criminal is not allowed to see his sisters in private? And when a group which has supposedly been set up to defend the constitutional rights of citizens, the ACLU, would rather defend the rights of homosexuals, traitors, murderers, and pornographers than a sincere patriot like Francis Parker Yockey, whose every thought and effort was in behalf of his fellow man? Are we free, I ask, when a judge can rule that a prisoner is not to have a, quote, speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, as guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, but instead must have a mental examination for the obvious purpose of eliminating a jury trial altogether? And finally, are we free when another group, vastly more powerful than the ACLU or the government itself, so powerful indeed that men dare not speak its name above a whisper, unless in the most groveling terms of praise, are we free when this group is able to dictate to the government the exact procedure which is to be used in disposing of troublemakers like Francis Parker Yockey? If such things as I have enumerated can happen, and they did, then our vaunted freedom is a fake thing, an empty word given to us by our watchful masters to keep us amused and quiet, as a parent gives a shiny bauble to a child. It is enlightening to review the standard means whereby our masters combat positive ideas and movements. There is a pattern in such tactics which constructive forces will do well to study. The first tactic is suppression and determined non-recognition of the rebel and his works. The press will unanimously give the well-known silent treatment. Even at this early stage, if the movement gives promise of becoming significant, assassination is considered and carried out if possible. The murder of young Newton Armstrong Jr. in San Diego on the night of March 31, 1962 is a case in point. Quoting from Che Guevara's book on guerrilla warfare and the question of when to resort to assassination, quote, "It is generally against the policy of the Communist Party to resort to assassination. However, it requires two criteria in a high-level policy decision. Criteria for the individual in question are that he must be highly effective, and it must serve some sort of example, some sort of highly effective example." The next tactic is the smear through libel, distortion, misrepresentation, and the sowing of confusion wherever possible. This may be a negative smear with the purpose of destroying the effectiveness of an enemy, or a positive smear for the purpose of building a haze around the truth to enable a disintegrative movement to develop. The falsification of the truth about Castro, which was indulged in by virtually all of the press and, of course, the State Department, is a classic example of this. The smear is usually started as an underground whispering campaign that viciously builds up to an outright and overt campaign with the free press called into play. The object is to isolate enemies of the present regime and discredit them. The third tactic is infiltration into the movement and/or the building up of false leadership in order to sabotage the movement at an optimum time, meanwhile diverting patriot energies into harmless or controlled activities. The fourth and final stage is called upon only as a last resort, after the movement or philosophy has become institutionalized and is immune to grosser tactics. This is to interpret it so as to bring it as closely as possible into conformity with approved patterns. Characteristically, the conflicting philosophies of Jesus Christ and Friedrich Nietzsche have suffered this deadening interpretation. Two or more of the above maneuvers are usually used simultaneously. For instance, says Cardo, in addition to the suppression of his imperium, Yaki was also victimized by the smear, and he was also in danger of assassination, and his enigmatic end settled the problem. Now it is with no gift of prophecy that one may predict that this present republication of his work will call forth the same sequence. Block quote. I tell you that the injustice of it all is enough to drive one mad. How can a man stomach the cynical or ignorant drivel of the liberals as they whine for freedom of speech and the right to dissent and shake their bony fists at conformity and all the rest of their legerdemain, when one knows that these moral cripples and ethical perverts demand their peculiar freedoms only for those who are working to destroy the West? We have seen their reaction when one committed to saving the West is in need of some of their medicine. No space on the right. That's Marcusean idea, Jewish communist who came to America and the father of the new left. No place for the right, no room for the right. Repressive tolerance, that tolerance means giving what they call alienated, marginalized, left-wing minority voices ample scope to make their case and suppressing any normal white voices. And that's how the left does it. It was like a certain wise old reporter whispered to one of Yaki's sisters as she slumped tearfully and quietly in her solitude, quote, your brother is a martyr, the first of a long line of them if we are to take back our country from those who have stolen it from us. A surprising word on the Yaki affair came some weeks after his death and was provided by the tight-lipped silence of the man who had been charged with railroading him to the insane asylum, the United States attorney. Suddenly, inexplicably, he resigned his job, left his wife and children, and joined a monastery. Let us assume that at least one devoted servant of the democracy has a conscience, even if displayed a little late. Please allow me to expose to you my prejudice so that there will be no misunderstanding. I favor the survival of our Western cultural organism. I love those who fight for the integrity of the West, whoever they may be. And as much as I fear and mistrust the outer enemies of the West, I despise our inner enemies and the cowards who support them all far, far more, and I hate their putrid doctrine that calls our continuing degradation, quote, inevitable. Further, I believe that the West can survive. It all hinges on faith. Faith in our future, faith in our superiority and survival. Skepticism, sophistication, cosmopolitanism, cynicism has destroyed the old faith, and it has not been replaced by a new one. But faith is and will always remain the essential ingredient in every historical force. Only a unifying faith can provide the common motivation for survival, the just and deep conviction of our right to live, and spark the single-minded and intolerant power which can clean and redeem our fast-decaying, rotting milieu. Very simply, the imperative of inspiring that faith is the central problem of our time. And when I say survive, I mean nothing more, for we are so far gone. Our philosophies, liberties, and cultural patterns are so perverted or eroded that bare survival is all that is possible. I mean to say that those who are to save the West must realize at the outset that only part of it can be saved, that much must be sacrificed, and the resulting structure will be different from the past. Those who have gone before have allowed the dank winds of change to corrode the old life, and many weeds have sprung up which cannot be entirely eliminated. It is one thing to fight for an attainable ideal, but another to sacrifice for a lost cause. In determining what is attainable and what is forever lost, a philosophy of history is needed. And although our job is to rebuild, we must not lose sight of the reality, for we cannot rebuild until we have captured. Political power is the essential criterion, not wishes or windbags. And to the goal of political power, all else must be temporarily sacrificed. To say less is to ensure defeat. He who is on board a sinking ship in a storm may be required to throw all his possessions overboard if this is necessary for common survival. Or to use another image, those who would guide the West back across the Styx and out of the dark must travel first through the gates of hell. Look. The practical problem of the recapture of political power divides itself into other questions. For one, is it possible to formulate an ethic and faith which, in itself, offers at least as much popular attractiveness as the painted lie of Marx? For another, how can those who would naturally lead such a movement compete with the highly developed Leninistic operational diabolism in the perpetually savage and untamable jungle of political warfare? Or is it necessary to do so? After all, the conspiracy we face is the hideous monster spawned of four millenniums of experience in guile and deception. So much so, in fact, that its main ally has always been the obtuse blindness of those on whom it feeds. Struggle to a man of the West means bullets, armies, and aircraft carriers. But to our enemy, international wars are of little meaning. Struggle to him means not war, but politics, and accordingly he has perfected his weapons in this most decisive of arenas. Soldiers have never made good politicians, and by the nature of their respective crafts, the soldier must always lose to the man of politics. Finally comes the main consideration in formulating such a doctrine. Will it certainly eradicate the political, social evils and diseases of our day and lead mankind to a better world? It is by this standard and no other that you will, if you are wise, judge the work of Francis Parker Yockey. To quit the search for such an ethic is to abandon history like the intellectual and spiritual nihilists, the liberals and beatniks. To quit the search is to turn over to the inner enemy, carte blanche, control over our lives, souls, and fate. The failure to provide this philosophy is not alone the fault of the saprophytes among us, however. Nor is it only the fault of the chameleon-like inner enemy of the West, the culture distorter, to use Yockey's apt term, which mercilessly persecutes and smashes all who dare to cry out against our rapid decline and degeneration. In truth, in all truth, it is mainly the fault of the many thousands who fully know the issues at stake, yet have not the moral courage to identify and fight the culture distorter, or, worse yet, who have, by diligent self-persuasion, convinced themselves that the battle for survival against an enemy that demands nothing less than total surrender can be fought and won with tax-deductible corporations, measured, moderate words, and avoidance of extremists. These Danny combatants swarm over every anti-communist movement like ants on sugar. By shrilly demonstrating their anti-communism, they bribe their consciences to give them peace and often go so far as to join in the crucifixion of those few with moral courage, lest they too be adjudged guilty by association. America has too many of such anti-communists and too few real patriots. There is much in Imperium which can easily be misinterpreted. There is something for everyone to agree with, and there is something for everyone to disagree with. This is a distinguishing characteristic of every truly vital and revolutionary departure. Yockey's criticism of Darwinism is an example of the first possibility, and it should be borne in mind that he is speaking of journalistic Darwinism, not the theory of evolution. A related point is his usage of the word race. It would have added to clarity if another word, such as nobility, was used to describe those who feel the imperative of the age. For the genetic interpretation of race is a necessary, useful, and valid one if we are to see all of our problems clearly and accurately. Also, Yaki cites some tests of doubtful validity when he asserts that children of immigrants into America are quite different in anthropological measurements than their parents. There is no doubt some truth to this. There are bodily differences caused by food and climate, but such conclusions can be carried into the realm of Lysenkoism unless great caution is used. Trofim Lysenko is the Russian communist quack and high priest who, quote, proved, unquote, through his hocus-pocus, that environment and not heredity creates the man. Such a theory is the basic fallacy upon which the entire communist theory of man rests, though few people realize this. But heredity is a matter of genes, and genes never change except through mutation, unless genes of one type, race, are mixed with genes of another type, race. One of the best books on the subject to appear recently is Dr. Conway Zirkle's Evolution, Marxian Biology and the Social Scene, Zirkle. Evolution, biology, and genetic inheritance must be treated as matters of life facts, and any theory for the future has to accept them. Yaki's usage of the word authority may be a source of misinterpretation. Should be remembered that the individual enjoyed far more liberty in Europe under the monarchs than in America today. Doubters should familiarize themselves with Edmund Burke, Thomas Carlyle, Herbert Spencer, and the more recent work of Otto von Habsburg, The Social Order of Tomorrow, his book. It is sure that by the use of this word, he does not mean Marxist-type collectivization. Some readers have raised the question of Yaki's apparent anti-Russianism, and a clarifying word is necessary here. In later writings, Yaki made his views on Russia more clear. In fact, certain of his captors called him anti-American and pro-Russian during his San Francisco ordeal. Although this libel was, of course, vomited for the benefit of gullible newspaper readers, it shows that some of his later writings could have been interpreted as being pro-Russian, just as Imperium indicates an anti-Russian attitude. Of course, Yaki was neither pro nor anti-Russian. He was concerned with the health and continuity of the West, and his view of the rest of the world was at all times subjective to what he considered in the best interest of the West at that time. Accusations of anti-Semitism, unless the imprecation is meant as simply having an open mind on the Jewish question, should be interpreted on the same level. The fact that he was captured in the home of a Jewish friend, even though that friend subsequently repudiated him, is instructive to the truth here.